Chapter 74. Bologna, 5 hours. Next day, Thursday, Florence, D. 5. Next year we will walk, for these excursions have got to be made over again. I've got 7 trunks, and I undertook to be courier, because I meant to express them to Florence direct, but we were a couple of days too late. All continental roads had issued a peremptory order that no baggage should travel a mile except in the company of the owner. All over Europe people are howling, they are separated from their baggage, and can't get it forwarded to them. I have to reship my trunks every day. It is very amusing, uncommonly so. There seemed grave doubts about our being able to get these trunks over the Italian frontier, but I've got a very handsome note from the Frankfurt Italian Consul General addressed to all Italian customs officers, and we shall get through if anybody does. The Phelpses came to Frankfurt and we had some great times, dinner at his hotel, the Masons, supper at our inn, Livy not in it. She was merely allowed a glimpse, no more. Of course, Phelps said she was merely pretending to be ill, was never looking so well and fine. The children are all right. They paddle around a little, and drive so do we all. Lucerne seems to be pretty full of tourists. The Fluelen boat went out crowded yesterday morning. The Paris Herald has created a public interest by inoculating one of its correspondents with cholera. A man said yesterday he wished to God they would inoculate all of them. Yes, the interest is quite general and strong, and much hope is felt. Livy says, I have said enough bad things, and better send all our loves to you, and Charlie and Ida and all the children and shut up. Which I do and shut up. S50. See, they reached Florence on the 26th, and 4 days later we find Clemens writing again to Mrs. Crane, detailing everything at length. Little comment on this letter is required. It fully explains itself. Perhaps a word of description from one of his memoranda will not be out of place. Of the villa he wrote, it is a plain, square building, like a box, and is painted light green, and has green window shutters. It stands in a commanding position on the artificial terrace of liberal dimensions, which is walled around with masonry. From the walls the vineyards and olive groves of the estate slant away toward the valley. Roses overflow the retaining walls and the battered and mossy stone urn on the gatepost, in pink and yellow cataracts, exactly as they do on the drop curtains in the theaters. The house is a very fortress for strength. The Mrs. Ross in this letter was Janet Ross, daughter of Lady Duff Gordon, remembered today for her Egyptian letters. The Ross Castle was but a little distance away. To Mrs. Crane, in Elmira. Villa Viviani, Settignano, Florence. September 30, 1892. Dear Sue, we have been in the house several days, and certainly it is a beautiful place. Particularly at this moment, when the skies are a deep leaden color, the domes of Florence dim in the drizzling rain, and occasional perpendicular coils of lightning quivering intensely in the black sky about Galileo's tower. It is a charming panorama, and the most conspicuous towers and domes down in the city look today just as they looked when Boccaccio and Dante used to contemplate them from this hillock 500 and 600 years ago. The Mademoiselle is a great help to Livy in the housekeeping, and is a cheery and cheerful presence in the house. The butler is equipped with a little French, and it is this fact that enables the house to go, but it won't go well until the family get some sort of facility with the Italian tongue, for the cook, the woman of all work and the coachman understand only that. It is a stubborn and devilish language to learn, but John and the others will master it. Livy's German Nauheim girl is the worst off of anybody, as there is no market for her tongue at all among the help. With the furniture in and the curtains up, the house is very pretty, and not unhomelike. At midnight last night we heard screams upstairs. Susie had set the lofty window curtains afire with a candle. This sounds kind of frightful, whereas when you come to think of it, a burning curtain or pile of furniture hasn't any element of danger about it in this fortress. There isn't any conceivable way to burn this house down or enable a conflagration on one floor to climb to the next. Mrs. Ross laid in our wood, wine and servants for us, and they are excellent. As he had the house scoured from cellar to rook, the curtains washed and put up, all beds pulled to pieces, beaten, washed and put together again, and beguiled the Marquise into putting a big porcelain stove in the vast central hall. She is a wonderful woman, and we don't quite see how or when we should have gotten underway without her. Observe our address above, the post delivers letters daily at the house. Even with the work and fuss of settling the house, Livy has improved, and the best is yet to come. There is going to be absolute seclusion here, a hermit life, in fact. We, the rest of us, shall run over to the Rosses frequently, and they will come here now, and then and see Livy, that is all. Mr. Fisk is away nobody knows where, and the work on his house has been stopped, and his servants discharged. Therefore we shall merely go Rossing as far as society is concerned, shan't circulate in Florence until Livy shall be well enough to take a share in it. This present house is modern. It is not much more than 2 centuries old, but parts of it, and also its foundations, are of high antiquity. The fine beautiful family portraits, the great carved ones in the large ovals over the doors of the big hall, carry one well back into the past. One of them is dated 1305, he could have known Dant, you see. Another is dated 1343, he could have known Boccaccio, and spent his afternoons in Fiesole listening to the Decameron tales. Another is dated 1463, he could have met Columbus. Evening. The storm thundered away until night, and the rain came down in floods. For while there was a partial break, which furnished about such a sunset as will be exhibited, when the last day comes and the universe tumbles together in wreck and ruin, I have never seen anything more spectacular and impressive. One person is satisfied with the villa, anyway. John prefers it to all Europe, save Venice. John is eager to get at the Italian tongue again now, and I see that as he has forgotten little or nothing of what she learned of it in Rome and Venice last spring. I am the head French duffer of the family. Most of the talk goes over my head at the table. I catch only words, not phrases. When Italian comes to be substituted, I shall be even worse off than I am now, I suppose. This reminds me that this evening the German girl said to Livy, "Man hat mir Jessic los si una candela verla tabe," unconsciously dropping in a couple of Italian words, you see. So she is going to join the polyglots too, it appears. They say it is good entertainment to hear her and the butler talk together in their respective tongues, piecing out and patching up with the universal sign language as they go along. 5 languages in use in the house, including the sign language, hardest worked of them all, and yet with all this opulence of resource we do seem to have an uncommonly tough time making ourselves understood. What we lack is a cat. If we only had Germania. That was the most satisfactory all-round cat I have seen yet. Totally un-Germanic in the raciness of his character, and in the sparkle of his mind, and the spontaneity of his movements. We shall not look upon his like again, S50. See, Clemens got well settled down to work presently. He found the situation, the climate, the background, entirely suited to literary production, and in a little while he had accomplished more than at any other time since his arrival in Europe. From letters to Mrs. Crane, and to Mr. Hall, we learn something of his employments and his satisfaction. To Mrs. Crane, in Elmira. Villa Viviani Settignano, Florence. October 22, 1992. Dear Sue, we are getting wonted. The open fires have driven away the cold and the doubt, and now a cheery spirit pervades the place. Livy and the Kings and Mademoiselle having been taking their tea a number of times, lately, on the open terrace with the city, and the hills and the sunset for company. I stop work a few minutes, as a rule, when the sun gets down to the hilltops west of Florence, and join the tea group to wonder and exclaim, There is always some new miracle in the view, a new and exquisite variation in the show, a variation which occurs every 15 minutes between dawn and night. Once early in the morning, a multitude of white villas not before perceived, revealed themselves on the far hills. Then we recognized that all those great hills are snowed thick with them, clear to the summit. The variety of lovely effects, the infinitude of change, is something not to be believed by any who has not seen it. No view that I am acquainted with in the world is at all comparable to this for delicacy, charm, exquisiteness, dainty coloring, and bewildering rapidity of change. It keeps a person drunk with pleasure all the time. Sometimes Florence ceases to be substantial, and becomes just a faint soft dream, with domes and towers of air, and one is persuaded that he might blow it away with a puff of his breath. Livy is progressing admirably. This is just the place for her. Remainder missing. To Fred J. Hall, in New York. December 12, 92. Dear Mr. Hall, November check received. I have lent the Californian story to Arthur Stedman for his author club book, so your suggestion that my new spring book bear that name arrives too late, as he probably would not want us to use that story in a book of ours until the author book had had its run. That is for him to decide, and I don't want him hampered at all in his decision. I, for my part, prefer that 1,000,000 banknote, and other stories by Mark Twain as a title, but above my judgment I prefer yours. I mean this, it is not taffy. I told Arthur to leave out the former squibber paragraph and use only the Californian story. Tell him this is because I am going to use that in the book I am now writing. I finished Poe's Extraordinary Twins night before last, makes 60 or 80,000 words, haven't counted. The last third of it suits me to a dot. I begin, today, to entirely recast and rewrite the first two-thirds new plan, with two minor characters, made very prominent, one major character cropped out, and the twins subordinated to a minor, but not insignificant place. The minor character will now become the chiefest, and I will name the story after him, Ughnead Wilson. Merry Christmas to you, and great prosperity and felicity. S. 50. Clemens. XXXIII Letters, 1893, to Mr. Hall, Mrs. Clemens, and others. Florence. Business Troubles. Ughnead Wilson. Own of Arc. At the Players, New York, the reader may have suspected that young Mr. Hall in New York was having his troubles. He was by this time one-third owner in the business of Charles 50. Webster & Company, as well as its general manager. The business had been drained of its capital one way, and another partly by the publication of unprofitable books, partly by the earlier demands of the typesetter, but more than all by the manufacturing cost and agents' commissions demanded by 50. A. L., that is to say, the 11 large volumes constituting the Library of American Literature, which Webster had undertaken to place in 1,000,000 American homes. There was plenty of sale for it indeed, that was just the trouble. For it was sold on payments, small monthly payments, while the cost of manufacture and the liberal agents' commissions were cash items, and it would require a considerable period before the dribble of collections would swell into a tide large enough to satisfy the steady outflow of expense. A sale of 25 sets a day meant prosperity on paper, but unless capital could be raised from some other source to make and market those books through a period of months, perhaps even years, to come, it meant bankruptcy in reality. It was Hall's job, with Clemens to back him, to keep their ship afloat on these steadily ebbing financial waters. It was also Hall's affair to keep Mark Twain cheerful, to look pleasant himself, and to show how they were steadily getting rich, because orders were pouring in, though a cloud that resembled bankruptcy loomed always a little higher upon the horizon. If Hall had not been young and an optimist, he would have been frightened out of his boots early in the game. As it was, he made a brave steady fight, kept as cheerful and stiff an upper lip as possible, always hoping that something would happen, some grand sale of his other books, some unexpected inflow from the typesetter interests, anything that would sustain his ship until ELA 50. Tide should turn and float it into safety. Clemens had faith in all, and was fond of him. He never found fault with him. He tried to accept his encouraging reports at their face value. He lent the firm every dollar of his literary earnings not absolutely needed for the family's support. He signed new notes. He allowed Mrs. Clemens to put in such remnants of her patrimony as the typesetter had spared. The situation in 1893 was about as here outlined. The letters to all of that year are frequent and carry along the story. To any who had formed the idea that Mark Twain was irascible, exacting, and fault-finding, they will perhaps be a revelation. To Fred J. Hall, in New York. Florence, January 1, 93. Dear Mr. Hall, yours of December 19 is to hand, and Mrs. Clemens is deeply distressed, for she thinks I have been blaming you, or finding fault with you about something. But most surely that cannot be. I tell her that, although I am prone to write hasty and regrettable things to other people, I am not a bit likely to write such things to you. I can't believe I have done anything so ungrateful. If I have, pile coals of fire on my head, for I deserve it. I wonder if my letter of credit isn't an encumbrance? Do you have to deposit the whole amount it calls for? If that is so, it is an encumbrance, and we must withdraw it and take the money out of soak. I have never made drafts upon it except when compelled, because I thought you deposited nothing against it, and only had to put up money that I drew upon it, that therefore the less I drew the easier it would be for you. I am dreadfully sorry I didn't know it would be a help to you to let my monthly check pass over a couple of months. I could have stood that, by drawing what is left of Mrs. Clemens' letter of credit, and we would have done it cheerfully. I will write Whitmore, to send you the entry check for $1,000, and you can collect Mrs. Dodge's $2,000. Whitmore has power of attorney which I think will enable him to endorse it over to you in my name. If you need that $3,000, put it in the business and use it, and send Whitmore the company's note for a year. If you don't need it, turn it over to Mr. Halsey, and let him invest it for me. I've a mighty poor financial head, and I may be all wrong, but tell me, if I am wrong in supposing that in lending my own firm money at 6% I pay 4 of it myself, and so really get only 8%? Now don't laugh, if that is stupid. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.